Hello and welcome to episode 423 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox, and with me is Ben Olson. We are the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Hey, if you're listening to this show on the day it comes out, which is Monday, October 9th, there is a free LSAT class happening today, and it is being taught by Ben Olson. Ben, are you excited about teaching this free class?
Yeah, free classes are always fun because so many people come and there's so much activity. We have to have extra TAs on call to answer questions in the chat. I think a lot of people get a lot out of it.
Extra tutors on call, right? I mean, we should. Yeah. It's not like it's just some random TAs.
Yeah,
it's,
that's it. Okay, we should clarify. These are highly qualified LSAT tutors who are on the Demon team, and they are asking questions just as they would if they were in one-on-one tutoring.
Answering questions, yes, in the background. Yeah. While Ben teaches his amazing class, do you know what the topic is going to be on?
It's logical reasoning, I believe, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, so you register for that at lsat.link/free. And yeah, that's today. Hey, by the way, if you can't watch it today, we will post a recording of it within 24 hours. So if you're listening to this right now, you can either watch it live happening today on Monday, October 9th, or watch it whatever today is. Just watch it because it's recorded and it's on our website in the future. Fantastic. Yeah. We have an announcement, which is LSAT Demon Basic is now $38 per month for people who have an active LSAC fee waiver. Premium and Live are 20% off if you have that LSAC fee waiver. Everybody should apply if you think you have like even close to a chance. You should apply for this LSAC fee waiver because you get a couple free LSAT tests. You get their credential assembly service or whatever they're calling it now. I don't remember what they changed the name of that. The application service that you have to have in order to apply for law school. You get a whole bunch of free shit if you get the LSAC fee waiver, including discounts with us if you end up wanting to do your LSAT prep with us. Again, it's $38 a month for basic or 20% off of our higher plans if you qualify for the LSAC fee waiver. We have a few quick September LSAT score release shout outs. Ben, you want to read these and maybe the email from Alex as well?
Sure. First bullet point, TH. I don't know who that is, but this person is apparently an ESL student, went from the mid 140s to 175 after 2 years of study and six official attempts. They appealed LSAC to get a sixth attempt. Wow.
But Ben, doesn't that look really bad to take it a sixth time?
Yeah, it's a bummer. I mean, geez. No, it does not look bad. And look at the 175. That's insane.
Yeah,
I mean, two years is a long journey, but this applicant now is going to have an easy road to the best schools in the country.
That's a 35 point, by the way, it looks like. No, mid 140s. Okay, so let's say it's a 30 point improvement.
Yep.
30 point improvement from the mid 140s to a 175. And my joke about the doesn't it look bad to take it a sixth time. See, that's totally bullshit. That's totally the terrible way of thinking about it. Ben responded to my sarcasm with more sarcasm.
Sorry.
But the lesson there is it's always going to be better to take it again if you end up scoring some kick-ass score. And this student knew based on their practice test scores, they knew that they could do better, and they had already exhausted their five attempts, and they appealed to LSAC and got a sixth attempt, whatever their grounds for appeal. I don't know what it was, but it's not.
That's what I want to ask, actually. TH, please tell us.
Let us know.
How did you appeal this?
Right. Yep. Right. I mean, I have a feeling it's not. Remember that one that we read not too long ago where it was somebody was like, basically their complaint to LSAC was my practice tests are higher, so I want another chance at it. That's not a reason that they're going to give a shit about. I'm sure it's, got to explain that there were some hardships, whatever those are. Anyway, my point is, if TH's highest score on record was a 168 after five attempts, and then on their sixth attempt, they get a 175. Well, would you rather take it six times for a 175 or five times for a 168? You would definitely rather take it six times for the 175 because the highest score is the only thing that really matters. It's free. It's not monetarily, you're going to still pay a couple hundred bucks to take the test, but it's just another bite at the apple. And really, you know, the only thing that matters is when you get it. It doesn't matter all the times that you miss the apple. When you get the apple, you got the apple now. So keep taking the tests, the official test, until you match your practice test scores is the lesson there. All right. And what else do we have?
Well, your example there, by the way, went from a 168 to a 175, which is it's a slam dunk win, right, with the 175. But even if you're going from a 174 to a 175, if you have the GPA to justify it, the difference between a 174 and a 175 is significant at the best schools. Because there are people who are not getting in with a 174,
100%.
But who are getting in with the 175 if that's now above their median. So
100%.
These retakes matter. Anyways, the next person is Anna. She went from a 160 to a 179 in 8 months. Pearson went from a 144 to a 163. Apparently been with the Demon since July of last year. And then we have Richard, who went from a 148 to a 170 in 6 months. These time frames are longer than I think maybe the average Demon student spends with us, but they're so worth it.
For the ones who, you know, I mean, all four of these students eventually got over the hump. And I think pre-law advisors do a bad job here of forcing people into this short timeline. You know, they always tell people, well, you know, 2 or 3 months to study for the LSAT. Sign up for a test that's 2 months from now and then start prepping.
Yeah.
And
then you think that's your limit too, right? You're like, well, that's all I did in 2 months. It's like,
And students also, like, they falsely, like, okay, so they're 2 months. They don't really improve that much, let's say. And then they just get discouraged and say, ah, fuck it. I'm just going to apply with this. Like, that's my aptitude or whatever. But it's not, it's just not an aptitude test. I mean, it's partially an aptitude test. But as TH and Anna and Pearson and Richard demonstrate here, over the course of 2 years or 8 months or a year about or 6 months, they were able to improve by 30 points, 19 points, 19 points, and 22 points.
22, yeah.
Respectively. And, you know, I hope that pre-law advisors out there are listening to that message and going, oh, maybe I should stop telling people that they don't really improve when they retake the test, or that they don't really improve if they prep over time.
Yep. I hope they're listening. Here's another email from Alex. It says, hey, Ben and Nathan, I emailed you after I received a 174 on the August LSAT administration. I sat for the September LSAT and scored 180. I may be an insane person for retaking a 174.
No.
But I think it will pay off.
Yes.
It will. I started with a diagnostic of 158. On my first official test, I scored 168. Yeah, 174 is astronomically better than a 168, and a 180 is still astronomically better than a 174. Maybe not as different as going from 168 to 174, but boy, it's a great, it just puts you in a position that your LSAT is not what's keeping you out of the very best schools in the country. Now it's really the rest of your application and your GPA.
Yeah, I mean, let's take a tip, you know, look at the tip of the pyramid, right? Like the shit pyramid that is legal hierarchy in general. It starts with Yale. Yale's at the very top, looking down at everybody else. And if you're a 168 applying to Yale, you are almost an automatic deny.
Yep.
If you are a 174 applying to Yale, you are below their
median.
You're
not an automatic deny, but your odds are against you. Yeah,
because you're below their median, but you're now in the conversation. Like, they admit people, a lot of people with 174s.
Yeah.
They, you know, like half the class probably has a, I mean, what's their median? I can't remember what it is most recently.
I think it's 176. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
wild.
So, but that means that, you know, half their class is below 176. So 174 is like, okay, you're below our median, but you're not killing us. And you're in the conversation at a school.
You're in
like
the conversation,
Yale.
But you have to hit really well with your GPA.
Yeah. And with a 180, you're not a shoo-in to Yale, because no one's a shoo-in to Yale. They like to deny, you know, they're going to pat themselves on the back that they deny some people who get 180s. But if you have the GPA to match and you've got the 180, Well, then now you're exactly the sort of person that they admit. That's how they get their median to 176, is they admit half their class with a 176 or higher. And when you went from a 174 to a 180, I mean, I would argue that it might be a bigger difference at this at a school like Yale
at the top.
Going from 174 to 180 dramatically improves your chances at Yale. Going from a 168 to 174 also dramatically improves your chances at Yale, but I would say less so than the 174 to 180.
Yeah.
Anyway, congratulations to TH, Anna, Pearson, Richard, Alex. Note that Alex took it three times, you know, 168. Like some people would think that he's insane for retaking a 168.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And law schools themselves will give you that advice. Like a school where 168 is like just below their median would be like, oh no, I mean, you're absolutely, that's right in the range for us. You should apply. Most people don't really improve their LSAT. So, you know, I mean, you might improve by a couple points, but no, 168, you're like, that's right in our range. You should apply. And if their median is 166, they'll be like, oh, 160. Oh, you would never retake that. That's more than enough. Like it won't
you're
matter.
Good. Yeah. They don't want you becoming more attractive to other suitors.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the jealous boyfriend or husband who hates it when his girlfriend or wife works out.
Hmm.
Which to me never, it's like, wow, that's absurd that that would be you. But there are those people out there. I have heard stories of people that are out there that are like that, that are super jealous. It's like, well, no, I don't want her to get hotter because then she'll leave me.
Yeah.
And, I mean, but that is what's happening at these other law schools where, you know, they have incentives that are going to make it so that they're going to give you bad advice.
Yeah.
Because they don't want you to leave them.
Yeah.
But for all five of these students, I'm super glad that you wrote us. I'm super glad that you were successful using LSAT Demon. I can't wait to hear what your admissions cycle looks like, you know, when you apply early and you apply broadly. I can't wait to see all the offers that come rolling in. So please get back in touch with us. By the way, our website is thinkinglsat.com, and you can always send us updates or news or whatever via our website. Next email. Yeah, so the October LSAT is almost here, and producer Eric tells us that a few listeners have asked, how should you study during test week? And here's a suggestion from Anonymous about how to study during test week.
Okay.
We could almost make this a pearls versus turds. Hello, it says. I've been preparing full time for the August and September LSATs, and I've recently been doing two full practice tests per day.
What the?
I was waiting for that to hit Ben.
Like, huh? Sorry, I was thinking about pearls versus turds. I'm like, oh, we haven't used that term in a while. There's a little something about off-putting about it. And I was like, well, maybe we could do red light, yellow light, green light. But regardless, I then came back to reality and you reading this. And yeah, that's not good.
That's not good. Light. Two full practice tests per day is insane. Anyway, surprisingly, says Anonymous, I have consistently done better on the second test of the day compared to the first. My recent scores, 166, first of the day, 172, second of the day. Then 167, 170, 171, 179, 170, 174, 173, 180, 174, 176, and 173, 177.
Okay. This is interesting. Of all the people on the planet who could get away with doing two full practice tests per day, this correspondent could be one of those people because they're scoring in the 170s. So thank God they're not scoring in the 160s or 150s and then just burning through so many questions without having a chance to review them. I actually believe this person could review these tests. I would prefer they do fewer.
I mean, the day that you get a 166 and then a 172, there's a lot of mistakes there. There's a lot of mistakes to get a 166. There's a lot of, there's even, you know, pretty good handful of mistakes to get a 172.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of these scores are below 175? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10 of those scores are below 175. You know, this indicates to me a couple things. Well, I mean, extremely high volume, like extraordinarily high volume. Like, what are you doing high volume? We don't really like it when people study full time. And, I don't know. It's intense, I guess. Yeah. Hope you're not burning yourself out. Hope you're not getting discouraged, distracted. You know, hope you're taking it seriously. And are you actually learning from all of those mistakes? When you're doing two tests a day, like, are you really reviewing the first test, then doing the second test?
How much are you getting out of it?
It feels like pulling the lever on the handle. Like, you're learning something by osmosis, probably, by just doing this much volume. Like, you have to be, because you're steeping yourself in it, you're definitely learning something. But I don't know if you're learning as much as you would be if you had slowed down and just, like, actually learned something from each of those tests.
Yeah.
Anyway, in fact, in my last 5 days, says Anonymous, my lowest score from the second test of the day is equal to the highest score on my first test of the day. I'm going to go back and look at that record. Yeah, so the highest first test was 174, and that is the lowest second test in the last 5 days. But that's, like, actually the last 5 days. My question is, what about the 50 LSAT questions that you missed along the way? Why are you missing those questions? Why are you leaving those points behind? I've tried warming up for my first test of the day by doing one reading comp passage, two games, and 5 to 10 LR questions, but nothing seems to replicate the advantage from the full warm-up practice test. All my friends who are also studying for the LSAT think it's crazy to do a full PT the morning of the real test, but based on these numbers, it seems rational to me. I would love to hear your thoughts. Thanks. I kind of want to talk about the placebo effect a little bit here. I was listening recently to some commentary about the, the Sudafed that, like, was on the shelves that then basically it got removed from the shelves or whatever. It's going to get removed. I don't know what happened.
There's some chemical in Sudafed that's been shown not to be effective for congestion or something. It is effective for something else, but
this is the point I wanted to make, is that it hasn't actually been shown not to be effective. So here's the deal. There's two types of Sudafed. There's the Sudafed that you have to ask for, that you get behind the counter, the kind that you can make speed from, apparently. And then there's the Sudafed that's been on the shelves for 30 years that you can't make speed from. And apparently it's that shit that they're now saying doesn't work better than a placebo. Not that it doesn't work. That it doesn't work better than a placebo. And I heard a physician commenting on this, saying that this might say something about the efficacy of this particular drug, but it doesn't say that the drug doesn't work. It just says that it doesn't work better than placebo. And another way of interpreting that is that the placebo effect is real.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I look at Anonymous's data here, it's hard not to imagine that after the first, I got a 166 one day and I got the first test of the day, and then I got a 172 the second test of the day. Wow, yeah. I did better on the second one.
Yeah.
Next day, 167, 170. Wow, I did better on the second one again. And the fact that you think there's a thing there can absolutely make it be so that there is a thing there. Because the placebo effect is extremely powerful, as it turns out.
Yeah, this person does have quite the consistent data to report in terms of worse, better, worse, better, worse, better.
But it could be fully explained by the placebo effect.
Sure, but it's still effective, right? I mean, that's one counter to the placebo argument.
Yeah.
Is that, well, placebos do in fact work. So should this person take a full test before their actual test on the official test day?
Only they can decide.
I would be very curious, by the way, when are you signed up for your official test? And is that close in time to whenever you do your second test? Because if you're doing your second test in the afternoon and your official test is scheduled for the morning, and then you're taking a test before that.
Get up at 4 a.m. to take a full test.
That does not sound effective at all.
Doesn't sound effective. Does sound kind of like lawyer shit. I mean, I got to say that many of the lawyers that I know are actually crazy people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's this type of unbelievable work grind.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that makes successful lawyers. I'm not saying it's the only thing that makes successful lawyers, but it is a pretty common trait, you know, like workaholic, like just, you know, your friends think you're crazy for working that much.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lawyer.
Yeah.
It's not the only lawyer. Not all lawyers are like that, but it is a pretty common trait. And so maybe this person just has a wildly different work ethic than I do. So to me, this looks insane, but maybe it makes perfect sense for them. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I would like them to experiment with one test every other day. And then in between that, doing time sections / drilling. Drilling is going to be very time efficient for you because it's going to be giving you the hardest questions. And so I don't know which questions you're getting wrong, but can you replicate high scores even at a slower clip? And then just review more.
And can you just learn more from the mistakes you're making? This seems to have been working for Anonymous, but that, you know, maybe there's other things that could work better.
Yeah. Experiment. Okay. Cool. You have the mental Thanks for writing in. To Sorry, do so.
Really interesting to think about it. All right. So we have an update here regarding Prometric test centers from Demon student Serena. Ben, why don't you take a look?
Yeah, it says the current LSAT testing center policies require test takers to use the scratch paper provided by the center. Okay, so you show up at the in-person test and they give you some scratch paper and they say, you got to use this. You can't use your own shit. That makes sense to me. Prometric gives students 2 pencils and 3 booklets of blue scratch paper. Wow, it sounds excessive. Prometric says that this is in the name. This is the same in all their test centers. In-center test center test takers cannot use graph paper or pens. This threw me off, and when I saw this game's recommendation to use scratch paper, I thought y'all would want to know about the new procedures. Smiley face, Serena.
We've been really discouraging people from going and taking tests at the Prometric test centers. I mean, scores have shot up since COVID. Scores have shot up since people started taking the test online at home. Correlation does not equal causation. But one of the reasons why we think scores have spiked is because people are just more comfortable taking the LSAT in their own controlled environments. That's not to say that the online proctoring has been perfect, but unless you really can't get yourself a quiet place at home, I don't know why you would want to go check yourself in. Like, you've got to commute to the place. You've got to meet strangers. You've got to sit in an unfamiliar seat with unfamiliar blue scratch paper with pencils that aren't yours to work on a computer that's not yours. Why are you trying to put yourself in an unfamiliar environment? Now, probably doesn't make any difference to many people. You know, like if I had to go take the LSAT at a Prometric test center, I would do just fine. Because I'm good enough at the content of the test that like that type of shit's just not going to bother me. But
from scratch paper for graph paper to just plain old
whatever
paper is not going to
make me do it in crayon on the back of a kid's menu. I still figure it out. Right.
Yeah.
But for people who are a little, you know, if you're at all anxious about this test, I just I can't imagine that this would be helpful to you.
Hmm.
I don't know. We also have a link here. Thanks, Serena, for sending that in. That is interesting. So if you like using graph paper, you can't use the graph paper on the official.
And we do link to, we link to graph paper in our game. So one thing we may want to do is just add a little note, by the way, can't use this in-person test centers. Yeah.
That's a good idea. Yes.
Yeah.
We also have a video here. I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to click on it right now just to see how this goes. If Eric has to cut some of this out, that's fine. But I'm going to click on this. What to expect on test day. it walks you through how it looks inside the test center lockers and whatever. If you are going to take the test in person, I would certainly check that out. I think that 3 minutes and 45 seconds could help you to feel a little bit more comfortable on the day of the test.
Yep.
Next one is from Imani. The subject is being an adult sucks. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I hope you are both doing well. I need advice on how to create a better work-life balance for myself. I graduated from college in May and started my first big girl job right after that. I work in the nonprofit sector as a housing coordinator, helping the homeless, similar to the guest in episode 420, which is very emotionally and mentally draining. I'm a Demon Live student and I frequent Nathan's Thursday class. However, I haven't returned in 3 weeks because I can't muster up enough energy to use my brain past 6 a.m. I feel past 6 p.m. Sorry. I feel like I'm wasting my money because by the time I get home, it's too hard to open up my laptop again. I plan to apply to law school next cycle, but at this rate, I don't know if that's possible either. I generally study on the weekends, but I know that's not enough for the score that I want, which is 170 plus. I'm afraid if I don't get it together now, I may get stuck in this job and won't apply. Please help and roast me if you want. Thanks, Imani. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts. One, I don't know how long you graduated in May and it's now October. The reason I was wondering is that almost anything you do, you're going to slowly get better at it, more able to handle it, right? But I mean, it's been several months. Why are you doing this job? Is it really something that you want to do? Then maybe you just accept that and you do this job and then you do premium. You don't do live during the week and you study on the weekends and you just recognize that you're going to need more time to improve your score on the LSAT. On the other hand, why are you doing this job? If it's not that important to you, find another job. Like in America, so many people give their souls to their job.
Yeah.
Make sure you're giving it to the right job.
Yeah. And we get advice from our parents, or at least I got advice from my parents about, you know, don't quit one job until you have another job lined up. And this kind of like idea that you should be grateful to have the work that you have. I don't really think people should feel that way. I think that, you know, employers should be grateful to have the employees they have. And they're lucky to have you, Imani. And if this is the right fit for you, then that's fantastic and you should stay. But if it's not the right fit for you, I mean, you describe it as very emotionally and mentally draining. There's other jobs that might not be so emotionally or mentally draining. In fact, there are other jobs that are emotionally and mentally rewarding. I'm a teacher, so it's real easy for me to say that. I mean, but it's true. Like I am emotionally and mentally energized by my work.
And you might even make more money. I mean, you might make the same or you might make less, but yeah.
I think you'll absolutely make more money. You know, I mean, the aphorism or cliche of do what you love and the money will follow.
Yeah.
It's a cliche for a reason, which is that, yeah, when you're really good at and love the shit that you do, then your customers can tell. And by customer, I mean, you know, your employer can tell. Mm-hmm. And if you're very emotionally and mentally drained by your job, you know, your employer can tell. And how successful are you being actually in this role, honestly?
It sounds like one of those jobs where probably everyone doing that kind of work is on some level being emotionally and mentally drained, which goes back to your point. The employer, this nonprofit, is lucky to have you, right? It's probably hard to fill these positions with people who can do them enthusiastically and well. And I bet on some level you are, but is it worth it?
Yeah. Is it worth it? You know, young people do have to, like, you've got young idealists, especially, like, you've got to learn that you are your most important asset. And you have to take care of yourself before you can help these people. So I get it that you're trying to help homeless people get housing, and that's awesome and admirable. And like, you know, I wish you the best in that endeavor. But if you're then not able to succeed, you know, if you're just drained emotionally and mentally, and then you're not able to move forward with your LSAT prep, if you're paused, you know, if you're stuck on your LSAT prep because of this, then I guess you've got to think long term and big picture and think about, you know, well, if I had a less emotionally and mentally draining day job, maybe I would be able to make more progress in my career, which would help me then solve bigger problems in the longer run.
Agreed.
Not that I want to turn everybody into some kind of bullshit effective altruist, right? Like that's not.
I you can totally go down that path, right? Oh, like you could do better for the world as
a multi-billionaire and then donate your money 5,000 years in the future, because that'll be the maximum, you know, that's
because no one actually does, right? They just go and buy boats and all that other shit. But I don't know. It's just like, it's is this the right job for you? And only you can answer that question. But there's some evidence here that it might not be.
Yeah, exactly. And so you do have to take care of yourself. As far as a more practical, like feet on the ground piece of advice, why can't you study before work? I mean, that's what we constantly keep coming back to people saying, if you've got a job like this, and because it could be in a law firm or whatever, like you could be getting your ass kicked in any number of jobs that brand new, you know, the big boy and big girl jobs of the world, like they tend to ask a lot. The employers want a lot out of you for not a lot of compensation. And so there's lots of different training jobs that you could have. We're constantly telling people, hey, I know you don't want to hear this, but you might need to become an early bird.
There's other
That's
things
the sacrifice
here too
that you might have to make. Go ahead.
I bet this nonprofit sector employer is very grateful to have you, and they would rather have you than have you leave.
Yep.
But you can go to them too and say, hey, look, I just can't start at 9 or 8 or whatever time you have to start. I have to start at 10, but I can stay a little bit later. I can go to 7. I can go to 6:30, whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Because your better hours are in the morning. Get what you need out of your day. Work out, do the LSAT, whatever it is, and then give the rest of your less productive hours to this job.
Couldn't agree more. Invest in yourself first and give your worst to not give your worst to your job. I'm being extreme, but yeah, give your best out. Pay yourself first. How about that?
Yeah. And it's not necessarily going to hurt. Like they still have you. And, you know, on some level, it's like, okay, you're doing, maybe you're slightly less effective than you might've been if you started with them earlier in the day. But the reality is you're doing 10 times more than nobody there. I don't know.
Most nonprofit jobs tend not to be 60 hours a week. You know, you're probably a 9-to-5-er would be my guess. If you're in nonprofit, you're making nonprofit money, you're probably not working like insane hours would be my guess. You should be able to find a place, yeah, before work, maybe during the day, like, hey, I need 12 to 1:30 every day. This is my private time. I'm going to be in a conference room with the door closed, or I'm going to go home or whatever. I'm going to like have this time.
Yeah.
Before work or during work. And if they're not willing to be flexible enough to let, you know, to have that be acceptable, yeah, then maybe it is time to look for a different job.
Last comment I do want to say, in episode 420 with the Legal Burnouts, Kate Bridle and Josie Hoff, they did say that the culture of these nonprofits sometimes is to give beyond, you know, the typical 9-to-5. So maybe you're facing that as well. I don't know. But anyways.
And in that case, you might really want to just, how are you going to make this investment? If you want to make differences in the world, do you want to do that via direct action in your day-to-day job right now? Or do you want to maybe think a little bit longer term? You know, if they're not willing to be flexible with you, then maybe you need to find another spot.
Yep. Cool.
All right. Next one up is from Daisy. The subject is thoughts on new medians and GPA addenda in wake of more grade inflation. Interesting.
Okay. Hello, Ben and Nathan and Demon Tutors. TLDR, thoughts on this year's UGPA medians? thoughts on writing an UGPA addendum when your UGPA is already high?
What?
UGPA, by the way, is undergraduate GPA. I absolutely love the podcast and have been bringing it, binging it the last few weeks. It's such an amazing resource and I appreciate all your work. Double exclamation point. You all discussed the rise in LSAT scores a few episodes ago, and I wanted to hear your thoughts about rising UGPAs, especially with quite a few of the top 20-ish schools releasing their medians already as high as 3.9 plus. I'm having a slight panic, hence the 2 a.m. email, because I was at or above roughly half of the medians with a 3.88 last year. My UGPA trend goes as follows: 3.67, 3.91, 3.96, and then a 4, with the lowest first year being in 2020. Should I note this in my application? Is a 3.88 even competitive for a T14 or T20 this year, despite the 170 plus LSAT? Okay.
Eric provided a link here to a page on lawschooltransparency.com. It happens to be my alma mater, University of California, Hastings, which I guess they need to change that name on Law School Transparency because that's no longer the name of the school. But in fall of 2018, that was the name of the school. And the GPA 50th percentile at Hastings was 3.44. In 2019, it's a 3.45. In 2020, it's a 3.42, little decline. Mm. But then in 2021, it's now a 3.52. And in 2022, it's a 3.59. That is a pretty dramatic increase in Hastings' 50th percentile GPA. Their 50th percentile LSAT has also clicked up a couple points.
Hmm.
You know, since the age of COVID, by the way, LSAT scores are up. In the age of COVID or in the age of post COVID now, taking the test online, the changed balance of the test, the fact that games is now 1/3 of the test instead of 2/3 or instead of 1/4, makes a big deal. That's a big difference.
Can you zoom out by clicking on show more?
Oh shit.
So then that the scores go, or the GPAs go back to fall of 2010. And in that context, it makes the 3.59 look like a pretty normal GPA within the range of GPAs that have fluctuated over the years.
Yeah. So now, and LSAT actually. So in 2010, their median LSAT was 164.
Yeah.
And now their median LSAT's 160. Their median 50, their median GPA was 3.6. Now it's 3.59. So when we look at it, in a broader context of a 13-year timeline, we're looking at a 4-point decline in the median and a slight barely decline in the GPAs.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a lesson there. just not to pay too close of attention to short data.
Yeah.
Hmm. What happens if we look at, the top though?
Okay.
'Cause this applicant was, particularly talking about 170 something, right?
Chicago. What do you want to look at?
Yeah, I'm going to look at Yale. Okay, so Yale, 10 years ago, or 13 years ago, fall of 2010, we were looking at a 50th percentile of 3.91. That's now 3.94. So, microscopic increase. The 50th percentile LSAT was 173. It's now 175. And that really only happened in COVID and beyond. Fall of 2021 is that first. Their median was exactly 173 from 2010 all the way through 2020. 11 years with an exact median of 173.
Wow.
Then in 21, it went up to 174. And in 22, it went up to 175. That I believe is definitely an artifact of the balance of the test changing, and online LSAT prep and taking the test at home.
Yeah. So we've only looked at two schools. Let's look at Chicago really quick, but it seems like there is more of a uptick in LSAT.
Okay. So looking at University of Chicago, LSAT, I mean, it was 171 in fall of 2010, and now it's 173. So that's just that's the same. It's Yale's 2-point increase. Chicago had dipped down in the late 20 teens. It had dipped down to 170 briefly, and now it's back up to 173. Grade inflation
back up, but it was 171, 170 for a long time, right? And then fall of 2020 hit.
Oh, and it's a 3-point improvement. Yeah. From 170 to 173. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it is clear that we know this. We know it's a fact that 175s and higher more than doubled in the past year or so, or a couple of years.
Yeah.
And again, my explanation for that, it's a hypothesis, but the hypothesis is they changed the balance of the test so that it's easier to now get, like, if you get perfect games, you get perfect 1/3 of your score instead of 1/4 of your score. And that's a big difference.
Yeah.
At that level, it's a big, big difference because you're just not scoring that high unless you got perfect games, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is online prep tools like the Demon. I mean, we see people improving now by 30 points, which just like didn't used to be a thing, right? I mean, we got like there's so many people now who start at 152 and end up in the 170s. Like, damn.
Yeah.
So yeah, what's the question from this listener?
Well, I think okay, so first of all, there's some panic here about the fact that they had a 3.88. Now the medians for GPA seem to have gone up. They appear to have gone up a little bit. They did for Chicago. Should they write an addendum explaining their grade?
This, by the way, Daisy wrote this at 2 a.m. apparently. Panicking about, looking at top 20-ish schools and their medians are above 3.9 and Daisy's is only a 3.88 and she wants to know if it's competitive in the T14 or T20.
Mm-hmm.
But Daisy has a 170 something LSAT. So the answer is yes. Like, yeah, you're right in the conversation, right? I mean, you were at one point at Chicago's GPA median. It's been kind of a long time though. And now you're slightly below Chicago's GPA median. That's a top school though, man. If we're talking about like top 20, I mean, what about, let's take a look at just one more school. I want to take a look at like UCLA.
Okay.
You could also look at, you know, Georgetown, WashU in Chicago, or WashU in St. Louis. Any of the schools that are like just outside the top 14, their median, UCLA has become quite a bit more competitive. Just a few years ago, their median was 3.72. Well, that was in 2018. Now their median is 3.9.
Yeah.
And their LSAT medians have also gone up 4 points since 2017.
And same pattern, very consistently oscillating between 167, 168 for years, for a decade. And then fall of 2020, they start to inch
169,
up.
169, then 170, then 171.
Yeah.
Oh, other elephant in the room, accommodations. We haven't seen updated information. We really need to see updated information on how many people are applying with accommodations. If any listeners have that information anywhere, I don't think we can find it on any of our websites that we know about. I don't believe Law School Admission Council has given an updated report on this, but it seems like, you know, we should have some concept of how many applicants are getting extra time on the law school admission test.
Yeah.
Because that's surely a contributing factor here. We've been talking about it on the podcast forever. We have never heard of someone getting denied accommodations. Can we still say it? That's wild to even say that out loud, but that we've been saying that for however many hundreds of episodes now of Thinking LSAT. We literally don't know of anybody who we know that some people who were denied and appealed and then got the accommodations.
Yeah.
But we don't, like, we haven't heard of anybody who has applied and gotten denied accommodations. since we started this podcast 7-8 years ago, whatever it was. Get in touch with us at thinkinglsat.com and let us know what you think about all that. Next email up is from Andres. Subject is, do I have a chance?
Hey guys, I'm 33 and have worked in logistics for about 10 years and I hate it.
Oh, okay. Good. That's good because you know you hate it, so you should fucking quit.
Yep.
That's clear. All right, what else?
I'm in the very beginning stages of considering law school and started listening to your podcast, and while I have hundreds of questions, my biggest one is this. Semicolon. Not correct use of semicolon there, by the way. Do I have a shot at getting in? Okay. Tell me some more. I was a clown in undergrad and barely got through. My GPA at the University of Louisville was an awful 2.4, I believe, and I graduated with a BA in history. I have an MBA with a better GPA from SNHU. Even if I crush the LSAT, do I have a shot at getting into a decent program? And if so, what are my odds at not paying full price? Thanks.
Okay. Well, you need to go to our scholarship estimator and play around with it. LSATdemon.com/scholarships. What that does is it takes last year's data and it says, based on public data, based on the 509 American Bar Association 509 data. By the way, there's a link there that tells our whole methodology if you're curious about how it works. But we're just making an estimate of here's how you would have done last cycle. So it's always backward looking, but it can give you a sense of what kinds of offers you might get at what kinds of schools. If you put in a 2.4 and a 170 LSAT, you're going to find that there are many, many schools which would be happy to admit you.
Yeah, I even put in a 165, and right now I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 full tuition, 7, 8, 9, actually about 9 full tuition scholarship offers. They're from schools at the very bottom. We're talking about schools ranked 170 plus. That has nothing to do with the LSAT, by the way.
But that's the league that you're going to be playing in. I mean, you know,
yeah,
you,
with a 2.4. Like,
yeah. Well, you haven't demonstrated on your academic record, like you haven't demonstrated top 14 type of shit, right? Like you haven't shown yourself to be the kind of worker bee that you're going to need to be in order to succeed in the top 14. That's not to say that you can't do it, because people certainly can change a lot over 10 years since being a clown in undergrad. But the admissions offices at the top schools are not, you know, they're going to be like, wait, but I've got so many applicants with a near 4.0. And, you know, I'm looking for people who are going to be successful academically, and you have not demonstrated academic dominance in the same way that all of our other applicants have. But decent program, where do we draw that line?
I don't know, but it's interesting. I put in the 2.4 and 170 that you suggested. A lot more schools open up as full tuition, still not very many, but most of them are ranked 110 or higher. Yep. There is one outlier, though, and that is Kansas, all by itself, ranked 40. So there's a possibility of a full tuition scholarship. So, you know, maybe you could get into Kansas or some other similar ranked school. But most schools are saying less than half. Yeah, at that tier.
But those are real schools. I mean, like that's a real school that makes real lawyers in the state of Kansas, probably.
Yeah.
You know, and you already did your undergrad in Kentucky, and you're, I don't even know where SNH, do you have any clue where SNHU is?
Nope.
That's where you got your MBA. Never heard of that. Oh, Southern New Hampshire University.
Okay.
There you go. You know, it's a regional school. Like I feel like you went to a regional undergrad, you went to a regional MBA, you're going to end up going to a regional law school. And there's nothing wrong with that because they make real attorneys there. I mean, they like, that's where the criminal defenders and criminal prosecutors come from in their state. And it's also where small firm lawyers come from. It's where medium law firm lawyers come from. And the big law firms in, you know, Louisville, they hire from law schools around Kentucky. So if you, you know, you have to go there and kick ass. But yeah, you've got all kinds of schools that are going to want to admit you, and you've got all kinds of schools that are going to want to throw you scholarship money if you get the right LSAT.
Right.
All right. Perry says, being a Georgia native, I will definitely be applying there next year. When I look at the 509, I'm going to click on that. The 75th percentile amount is more than in-state tuition. With a 170 and my UGPA of 3.85, I would be a splitter, but I would not require as much of a scholarship to receive a full ride. In my mind, it makes sense for in-state schools not to give as much to in-state students because obviously cost of attendance is lower. Do in-state schools not give full rides to in-state students as willingly as they give larger scholarships to out-of-state students? Or do they give out scholarships so that the cost of attendance is largely the same for students with the same hard factors, regardless of where they are from? Producer Eric says, I know a former LSAT Demon student who's now at UC Davis. This person received a bigger scholarship than I did, despite having a lower LSAT and GPA than I have. The extra scholarship almost perfectly matches the cost difference between in-state versus out-of-state tuition. Eric is an in-state student. And apparently this LSAT Demon student is an out-of-state student with worse numbers getting a bigger scholarship. Another friend of the Demon accepted a full ride scholarship and then, quote, wasn't allowed to switch to in-state tuition because the school wanted to claim the bigger scholarship allotment to showcase their generosity.
Wow.
That's an interesting hypothesis. I mean, I'm not sure. I feel like that might be coming from our anonymous correspondent rather than coming from the school themselves. Do you think schools want to show big scholarship numbers on their 509, though? I question that logic.
Yeah, seriously. It seems like they'd be embarrassed by what they're doing.
One would think, right? But I think that that's maybe part of the issue is that they, you know, the schools aren't, like, the schools do not. Well, they do and they don't, huh? Because they do try to recruit applicants by saying scholarships available. Then again, they don't like.
They don't want you to know how much they're giving out.
I don't think they do, which is why we are developing our law school roll call tool and a way of visualizing this data where we're going to be able to show you, hey, here's what a typical class looks like in terms of who's actually footing the bill.
Yeah.
I don't think they want to show that a lot. But anyway, what do you think about this general question? Do in-state schools give less scholarship money for in-state applicants?
I think they do because they have a lower tuition amount that they're dealing with, right? So if they give the same amount of scholarship, they're going to bring those people down to zero really quickly.
Right.
And they, no, that's not the real game here. What they're really doing is they're taking fake money and they're giving it out as scholarships.
Fake money. I mean, talking about like legal fictions, right? Or LSAT fictions in our earlier discussion, law school tuitions are just largely fictional.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, we charge out-of-state tuition, out-of-state students this, and we charge in-state tuition this. But then you look at it and like 85% of their class, both in-state and out-of-state, is getting some kind of a grant. And as Perry points out, you know, sometimes the school is giving out so much money at University of Georgia in 2022. Apparently, their 75th percentile grant amount was more than the in-state tuition. So they're either giving full ride plus stipend to a bunch of in-state people, or they're giving generous scholarships to out-of-state people to try to make that come to some kind of parity.
Yeah.
Your mileage may vary, and this is one of the many reasons why we apply broadly when we apply. Because you just don't know what kinds of offers you're going to get. And you need to apply to a wide range of schools, like 10, 15 schools at a minimum, so that you can see the types of offers that you're going to get. And like the outlying offers are the ones that are, you know, like somebody's going to make you a great offer. Like more than what the estimator suggests you would get. Somebody's going to make you a great offer if you apply broadly enough. At least that's our theory.
Yeah.
All right. Last one here from Sarah.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I recently scored a 171 on my last practice test and mid 160. to upper 160s before that. Okay. I'm aiming for mid 170s. My section tests now for LR and RC typically seem to be around 2 to 3 wrong, with about with logic games at around 1 to 2. I think that's what they're saying.
Yeah, I think they're saying that's how many wrong. Yeah.
Yep. When I review logical reasoning and reading comp, some of the questions I understand right away. Others, the more difficult questions, seem to come down to how I interpreted a particular word or words in the two answer choices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When all the answers are bad, how do you figure out which one is the least bad?
Mm-hmm. Great question.
Okay. Also, I know that I'm not perfect in logic games, though I'm very close. Right now, I'm signed up for October. Should I change my registration to November to take the or take the test in both November and October? I feel very close to getting where I want to be with this test.
Take the second issue first, man. I want everybody to be thinking about taking both of those tests. If you're taking either of those tests, I think you should be thinking about taking both of those tests. I just, like, if you're ready, which, you know, you're close.
But is this person really ready? I mean, they just scored a 171. They're aiming for the mid 170s, and their previous practice tests were mid 160 to upper 160s. Yeah.
Don't rush it. You know, Sarah, yeah. There's no point in rushing into either of these tests. So I'm not telling you to take October. I'm not telling you to take November. I am telling you, though, that if you're going to take October, you should be committed to also taking November. Like, it's just stupid to think about it in any other way. We have, you know, we hear stories, story after story after story of students who try to be one and done. They're hoping that, you know, October is going to be the one, and then it doesn't turn out. And then they're not registered for November. And next thing you know, they're taking it in January of next year. And then they're waiting a whole additional cycle. And, you know, we have stories like Elizabeth, former student Elizabeth, who's now at Harvard Law School.
Yep.
Elizabeth ended up taking it 5 times, but she did this plan on her first time through. Like, she signed up for one test. She took the test before she was really ready. Her practice test did not reflect the score that she actually wanted, but she took the test anyway. She underperformed. Then she had to retake it. She underperformed again because she still wasn't really ready. Her practice test did not indicate that she was actually ready. Then she prepped for a while. She found LSAT Demon. She started to actually understand the test. When she started to actually understand the test, her scores, her practice test scores, shot up into the 170s. And then she had an entirely different problem, which was she underperformed her practice tests on an official test. So she had to take it again. And then she did that again. And she had to take it a 5th time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until her 5th time that she finally got that mid 170 score that she was looking for. And now she's at Harvard Law School.
Yeah.
I want people to be like Elizabeth in that I want them to prep thoroughly, exhaust all of their attempts if necessary. Don't settle. But I want them to not be like Elizabeth in the early days, which was taking the test before they were really prepared, hoping for a one and done situation, putting too much pressure on every individual practice test. So again, my challenge back to Sarah is, if you decide that you're ready for October, then yeah, you absolutely should be thinking about taking it in November, just because you have to decide that you're going to exhaust all of your attempts. Once you're ready, you need to exhaust your attempts. What do you think about her first question about the particular word or words in the two answer choices? When all the answers are bad, how do you figure out which one is the least bad?
Yeah, well, in that case, sometimes you have to go back and reread the passage because you're just missing something entirely. There does seem to be a big focus on just the answer choices. That's where people get the question wrong. So they tend to think like, oh, this is what I need to fix. Like, maybe you're misunderstanding something about the passage, because a lot of times the closest wrong answer is actually not that close. Sometimes it is, but in a lot of cases, it's not.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's what you're missing. The other thing I'm thinking right now is, look, when you're comparing two answer choices, you should understand exactly what's the same about them and what's different, because you shouldn't be debating things that are similar. Right? Like, if two answer choices say the exact same thing in one part of the answer choice, then that's not what makes it.
Yeah.
Wrong.
You take that part of it out of the equation.
Yeah.
And you compare the parts that are different.
Yeah.
Yep. I totally agree with that. I wanted to approach it from a little bit of a different angle, which is to just say that on reading comprehension, you're really very rarely picking a bad answer. Like on reading comprehension, they're asking you what it said in the passage. Mm-hmm. And you might not like any of the five answers on the first read through. You might think that they're all bad, but one of them is not bad. One of them is proven by the facts. Like one of them is, oh, I see it. Here it is. Mm-hmm. There's the evidence. Mm-hmm. Because of this, I get to pick this answer. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I like it if Sarah is getting through all five answers and not liking any of them. I think that that's how you should be. Like your default mode should be like, these answers are garbage. I'm expecting these answers to be garbage.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pick the one that like, I can't figure out how it's garbage. These other four though, like no way in hell I can pick these. This one. Okay. There's the evidence.
Yeah.
But it is critical that you accept that the test has an inherent logic to it, that it like it, you have to play that game of, hey, the makers of the test intended one of these answers to be perfectly justified based on that passage that I just read. Yeah. And so I got to go back and find the evidence that, because there is evidence that justifies one of these. And maybe, you know, for four of them, you can eliminate because it's like, well, it definitely did not say that. It said the opposite of this. This is an exaggeration of what it said. I can't pick that. This one, I don't understand. I don't see how they proved it. And that's the one that probably there's just something in the passage that justifies it. On logical reasoning can be a little bit different because on logical reasoning, sometimes they're asking you strengthen or weaken questions. And on a strengthen or weaken question, sometimes the correct answer is not that great. Like it's not, you know, because it's not proven by the facts. That's not even the question they're asking you. They're asking you which one of these, if it were true, would help the argument, or which one of these, if it were true, would hurt the argument. And there, sometimes you have to think a little bit creatively to think about how this might be used to strengthen or weaken the argument. But again, four wrong answers are, you know, like they're asking you for a strengthener, and this wrong answer weakens the argument. Like that's, you know, that'll frequently be the case for two or three or even four wrong answers. Or they're asking me to strengthen the argument, and this one just doesn't do shit. Just irrelevant. Can't possibly strengthen this argument. Strengthens a different conclusion. Doesn't strengthen this conclusion.
Yeah.
The one correct answer is going to be the one that you can see a way. Oh, I see what they meant here. This helps their argument somewhat.
Yeah.
But that's pretty rare. More often than not, the questions are going to be more straightforward than that. And you just have to, you have to realize that it takes two mistakes to miss a question, right? You've got to pick a wrong answer and not pick the right answer. So you've got kind of two ways of getting in there to solve the problem. And on really hard questions, you might have to do some combination of process of elimination and also, you know, reinterpreting the way that you read that answer. So because there's one that clicks, right?
Yeah.
When we read it the right way, or when we read the passage the right way, which was Ben's initial advice, was like, hey, there's probably something there that you're missing. But if you read that question carefully, when you read the right answer the right way, it should like really click for you.
Yeah.
And the wrong answers are wrong and can be eliminated.
Yeah. And if you get there one way, right? If you get there by eliminating the wrong answers, or you get there by finding the correct answer, and you only use one way, well, ideally when you're reviewing, that's when you figure out the other way.
Right. Right. That you see both sides of all your mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's where people go wrong in their review so frequently, don't they? It's like they missed this question. And when you explain to them why the right answer is right, then they see it.
Yep.
But then they don't get critical enough also of the wrong answer that they chose, because that answer just doesn't do it. It doesn't do what that question asked you to do. It's not second best. It's almost always just a zero.
Yeah.
Like, or even a weakener. Like it's the opposite of what a correct answer would be.
You just missed something.
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
You can be LSAT famous. Ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about LSAT Demon, you email the world's best help team, help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 423 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.